Welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast. I'm John Vogel, TW's Creative Director. Since April is Poetry Month, we're airing an interview with poet Alan King. I first met Alan in the digital realm when Talking Writing was getting ready to publish two of his poems in 2020. For the audio readings of the poems, he had used music that we were not able to clear the rights for, so I took a crack at writing music underneath his readings. Both tracks turned out nicely, and Land of Innocence later was accepted for a collection on Adam Gnotti's literary tape label, Hello America. Alan works and lives in the DC area while fulfilling his role as husband and father in his family. In addition to his two books of poetry, Drift and Point Blank, he's published writings in numerous anthologies and journals, created documentaries, and worked as a videographer. In this interview, which I collected as part of my Perfect Recognition project on intense aesthetic experiences, we discuss his connection to music and poetry, as well as his development as a poet. Could you describe an instance when viewing, hearing, or creating a work of art that has caused an intense reaction?
So I'll just say it's happened like in different artistic mediums. So it's definitely hip hop. But in terms of theater, I was thinking about when I went to go see Step Africa. And so it was, what was so amazing about it was these dancers, like their skill set was just so amazing that the thing what they were trying to illustrate was that, you know, there were all these different scenes of like people walking down the street, like doing common stuff. But like imagine somebody walking regularly and you're just hearing like this, you know, this like these quick percussive, and it's like so effortless while they're going and those clicks are just going, but they're dancing while they're walking. I remember like that blew me away. And then there was like a scene with like a guy trying to talk to the woman on the corner and they're both tapping, but it's like so effortless. And, you know, they were doing things that I watch normal people do on the street, but they were able to add like this music to it. You know, so that was probably like one of the intense moments I've had. I mean, I've had it too when, so when I've heard Jennifer Hudson sing You're Gonna Love Me, she did the cut. Oh, and my body just like, I just got this chill running through me when she hit that high note. And I was like, okay, whatever pain or whatever she was able to muster up, like she was able to transfer that to me. And I remember just feeling it and was like, okay, she's not just singing this, like she's embodying, you know, like the emotions of the song. But I mean, those, and of course, favorite rapper, Pharoah Monch. Every time I hear Pharoah Monch, like it's very intense for me because of, you know, his rhyme patterns, his the amount of detail he puts in his delivery as well as the story. But yeah, those are some moments that I get like an intense reaction, whether I'm listening to something or watching a performance that I think really goes above and beyond where other performances go.
Could you describe I'd like to talk about if you could describe the emotions and mm-hmm. the feelings on sort of inside level, I guess, like mm-hmm. internal level.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that Jennifer Hudson song, like I wanted to cry because it was, you know, and I'm, you know, not to be macho or anything, and I do think it's okay for people to cry, but I've lost relatives. And, you know, like emotionally, I'm where, you know, everyone else is, but it's always been hard for me to cry. So I'm usually comforting people and stuff like that. But like when I heard that Jennifer Hudson song, And it just hit me that way. And I mean, not only just the chill, but, you know, whatever emotion she had it wasn't foreign to me. It was like something familiar. And I think, you know, a couple of times I've heard her sing, you know, forget the other song she sang, but definitely that song, You're Gonna Love Me, like, it always brings me near that edge where I'm just, you know, I'm like, whoa, like, I'm rarely at this point. And I think it's a good thing. And then another way that the intensity manifests itself is another rapper, MF Doom. So, like, if I really get into it, like, the intensity is in the imagery. Like, I feel like whatever story they're telling, like, I'm immersed in it. Like, I can see it effortlessly. Like, I'm not having to sit and, like, really work to try to see it. Like, it's the visuals are, like, playing before me as they say it. And so, I would call that an intense manifestation because, you know, I think in other situations, like, I would have to intensely be focusing to be able to get to that point. But, like, if I'm hearing, like, a Doom song that I like, I think one of them is America's Most Blunted. And, I mean, I crack up because I can see this crazy story playing out in my head. And when I went and read the lyrics, like, it even intensified because I even knew more, like, you know, I'm reading it. And so I'm getting even more of the visuals that I didn't get listening because I had missed a few things. But yeah, the intensity is usually visual because I'm a visual person. I'm a visual person when I create. So, like, some people, I often hear some poets in interviews will say, oh, a line came to me. And sometimes that happens, but if a piece comes to me, it's usually visual first, and then I'm trying to capture, you know, what these images are and trying to tell that story around it. So I think more so the intensity manifests itself visually for me.
How would you describe the roles of, expectation and subjectivity and familiarity when thinking about, like, what resonates with you? Like, 'cause there's a weird tension where, like, if something is too far out of the scope of what you like, mm-hmm. there's a good chance you won't like it. But if it's too much like what you like, it will seem derivative or redundant. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, in your own experience, how do you feel about that tension?
So, I think I balanced that pretty well because I've never... So, I guess the expectation, I always view that as coming from, like, outside forces, so, like, peer pressure and being pressured to like things because it was popular or whatever. And subjectivity, for me, was always me just kind of finding my own way and being like, you know, liking the thing that's not necessarily popular, but because it hits me and resonates with me in a way. And so some examples of that, it's just the music I listen to. Like, I tend to dig a lot for artists who aren't that well known because, you know, they may be saying something that commercial artists aren't talking about. And then that expectation, the pressure and the tension of the expectation is coming from family members that are like, well, who's so-and-so and who's this person? But then I think, too, in the literary space, and I wrote about this a while back, but I always thought it was ridiculous that the expectation from reviewers is to, you know, they'll review a book as soon as it comes out. But then when the book turns, like, 2 years old, it's like it's ancient, and they're ready to go on to something else. And I remember talking about, you know, if my book was an actual person, it would still have to hold a parent's hand across the street, you know? It was still, and so it's odd that, you know, there's this, yeah, the expectation for something new to be the thing that people should be checking out. And subjectivity for me is, like, I love going to bookstores and going to the bargain bins and, you know, getting the books that have been out for like, you know, 6 years, maybe even longer, and just enjoying it because of the quality of the writing, you know, what the, you know, writer was doing, and not getting caught up in the, again, the expectation of like, well, you know, this book is old, it's ancient, you know, and looking for something new. So, you know, I've always been the kind of person that's like, I like what I like, and I may like what, you know, is out there on a, you know, what's more known, but oftentimes than not, like I used to get bored with it and just kind of like, okay, I've been doing this long enough, like, you know, seeking out the people in the art that I enjoy, that I trust my instincts. And so I'm like, I trust it enough that if I enjoy it, then it's good enough for me. And I don't, like, what I enjoy doesn't have to be validated by other people. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, totally. And I feel the same way about, like, reviewers, because it also doesn't, the focus of that style of judging doesn't like take into account like the fact that you might react to something some way mm-hmm. at this point in time, and then 5 years mm-hmm. later it could mean a completely different thing to you because of your age, because of your mm-hmm. and because of the context of the time that you're living in mm-hmm. and there is a lot of art out there that actually, you know, seems to get better and more universal the further it is out from its release. And there are lots of artists who like died and were in like destitution mm-hmm. during their lifetimes who were discovered later. And I often think about like, well, what about all the people who were making art that they also died in destitution and then it was never discovered and it mm-hmm. could resonate with people later, you know?
I mean, I think about, and this person's still alive, you know, thank God, but like Sonia Sanchez, when I first got her book, Shake Loose My Skin, I got the book because at the time I was broke and I couldn't afford to go out and buy all of her books. So I was like, okay, this is a bargain. I could get a good chunk of her work. It was like her selected collectors. But at the time, I think when I got the book, like I didn't appreciate it as much then when I did, when I went back to it 3 years after I bought it. Like when I first got it, you know, like you said, like there were, I was just finding my community in DC, my arts community in DC, and I was just coming out of this period where like a lot of new poets, you know, don't want to read anybody because they don't want to be influenced by anybody, but I always say, you know, and they say, I don't want to sound like anybody else. And it's like, I always say, well, you unwittingly end up sounding like the other people who aren't reading because they don't, you know, making the same mistakes. But, you know, so I think for me, like I was still building my literary taste and, you know, what I like and stuff. And so Sonia Sanchez at that time was kind of like in a gray area. Like I liked some of the work, but then I couldn't understand, I couldn't enjoy the nuances that came later. And so I remember reading it cover to cover and then I put it aside. I was like, okay, I may get back to it. And then I think like the next year and then the following years, well, the ensuing years, like I kept picking it up, reading it from cover to cover. And I also learned some of the gossip, you know, from other writers. And so now I'm like, you know, so when I'm reading it, I'm like, oh, this is about Etheridge Knight. So I'm like, oh. And what's funny was because I had went out and bought The Essential Etheridge Knight. And so having gone through that and then going back through Shake Loose My Skin, I was like, okay, Wounded in the House of a Friend. There was one short story in there, but I was like, okay, that definitely has to be Etheridge Knight because the speaker's partner was fighting an addiction, and she ended up leaving. But then when I go over to The Essential Etheridge Knight, and read his poem, feel, I don't know if I can curse, but feeling effed up. And I was like, oh, maybe that was the night. You know, so it was so cool, you know, yeah, having that distance. And but also being more informed to enjoy it later, because I'm like, oh, okay. You know, whereas when I just started out and wasn't familiar with Etheris Knight and all the stuff, I didn't have like a background to kind of start putting things together and really seeing it in a whole different context and really being able to enjoy it in that sense. So yeah. And I think too, the role of writers isn't just to, and this, you know, I'm being subjective here. You know, I believe that the role of the writer isn't just to, you know, produce poems, collections, or short stories or books and stuff like that. I think the writer's role is to lift up other writers, whether that's like in reviews, annotations, or whatever. But like, I always saw the role of like writers bringing other writers who, you know, are no longer, you know, their books are no, you know, ah, I hate to say this, but I'll put this in air quotes, are no longer relevant. Their books are no longer relevant. Kind of like, you know, bringing them back into the discussion, you know, whether it's through comparing their work with other writers or some other way. But I always saw that the writer's role was much more than producing the art that they produce. You know, I always felt that there was like an advocacy in, you know, that piece, you know, bringing other writers back into the conversation was a part of that advocacy piece.
When did you start writing poetry, mm-hmm. and how did it come, like, what, I guess, first I would like to focus on sort of, like, what is your path from, like, maybe, I guess, like, college on?
All right, I'll go back even further. So my exposure to poetry was in elementary school, mm-hmm. and so I was in fourth grade, and my teacher at the time, Miss Garrison, she would make us memorize poems, and then we had to be able to stand up in front of the class and recite it from memory. And I remember I hated poetry because if we couldn't recite the poem, then we lost our recess. It's like standing on the wall, watching your friends play. And it wasn't until middle school when we did the unit on poetry again. And, you know, I think I started enjoying it, like, because I was doing a lot of rhyming poetry. And then the rhyming and the rhythm was fun. And actually it was a friend that wrote a poem. And we're still friends to this day, and I say that because of what I'm about to say. I looked at his poem, and I said, oh, that poem's terrible. He said, well, if you think you can do better, then you write one. So I remember I went home and started working on one. And I couldn't tell you if it was better than his, but what I do remember was like how cathartic it was for me, you know, that time. And it was fun. It was like a puzzle, you know, because I was writing rhyming poetry. So it's like, oh, well, you know, what else can I find to rhyme with this? And then I think the story, I leaned more towards narrative poetry because I think I got that from my dad. My dad is a storyteller. And so it was funny, like, even jokes would be classified as a story. So my father would say, hey, I got this, or stories would be classified as jokes. He said, I got this joke for you. And so whereas, and my parents are Caribbean, by the way, so whereas like African-American, like my, or anybody from anywhere else, my wife is Nigerian, when you say, oh, I have a joke, they're expecting like the, you know, pretty much the setup for the joke, right? And then boom, the punchline. But she had to get used to when I say, oh, I have a joke, that she's gonna have to hear the whole story before I get to the punchline. And so I got that from my dad, and then my dad would also, you know, he would imitate people, but not out of disrespect, but it was like he was, when he told a story, he wanted to tell it like if you were there. So he would imitate some of his customers, you know, and my father's an electrician, and so he would, you know, he would do that, or he would imitate people that he met. And then if the stories, if I thought the stories were hilarious, then I would relay those stories to the other people. And so it kind of found its way in my work because I was like, okay, I'm writing poems. What am I going to write about? And then I was like, it was, for me, it was obvious, tell stories. And so that's what I started doing. But in high school, the practice got a little bit more intense because, you know, I was using it to get girls, and then I had a girlfriend, and then I liked that I could use poems. So, you know, because, you know, you tell somebody you love them, when you first hear it, it's like, but after a while, it's kind of like, it gets watered down, it's not as special. And so, but the poems would always be a way of trying to keep it fresh, trying to, you know. And so, but then I remember, you know, just feeling at the time, you know, some of the girls at the school where I was going to, the high school I was going to, you know, I kind of felt like they were stuck up. So I wrote this poem about it. And I went by a pen name, and the poem went all around the school. And everybody's like, oh my God, the guys are reciting it. And they're like, yeah. And I was like, wow, just watching the effect that this poem had on there, you know, I was like, okay. And then I met my first living poet in my senior year of high school was my English teacher, Mr. Grimes. And he, up until that moment, always thought, you know, you write your poems in the journal. And from my experience, like the only time I read them was when we had company over and my parents wanted to show up. You know, but I didn't know what happened to the poems after that. You know, I just thought they just sat somewhere and collected dust. But Mr. Grimes would come in, and he didn't just teach poetry. He would bring some of his own poems, and he would say, hey, can I try something out on y'all? And I said, well, why you want to try this out on us? Oh, because I'm going to read this at the open mic. I said, well, what's an open mic? And my head is just getting hot because he's like, oh, and he starts going into what it is, and I'm like, wait a minute. So there is a place with a dedicated audience, and you can, and my head exploded. And then I was like, oh, so now there's another life for poetry beyond just the page. And I wasn't even thinking about publishing and all that stuff yet. I was still in high school. But when I got to college, I had a buddy of mine, he and I, we signed up to be like a little brother. And I ended up getting a big sister, and she found out I liked poetry, and she did some research, and we started going to Bar None. Bar None is not around anymore. It was one of those spots that was really cool to go to in the late 90s, but now it's boarded up. But yeah, that was my entry point into finding my community in D.C. So yeah, 99, I was a freshman at the University of Maryland. And I didn't really find my community in D.C. until, I'll say about 2001. Yeah, 99 was pretty rough because I wasn't reading anybody, was just writing what I felt, and I was getting heckled, booed, you know. But yeah, I think I got my footing in, I'd say about 2000, 2001, because I don't know if you remember OKPlayer.com.
I remember the name, but I don't think I ever used it or anything.
So it was the official website for the Roots. And so like they would have like the news on there and stuff, like where the Roots was going to be. But I used to post on the freestyle board. And what was so awesome was that OKPlayer.com was also instrumental in me building my community here, because it wasn't like your other message boards, like OKPlayer.com, there would be folks from the discussion board that always thought the people from the freestyle board was weird. But, like, they would do all these meetups. So it was like the D.C. OK Players would be like, hey, we're meeting at so-and-so for happy hour. And so folks from the freestyle board would go. And we started mixing with them. And then we started doing road trips to meet the Philly OK Players, the New York OK Players, and all that stuff. But a lot of the people I met on the message board that were in the D.C. area, one of them ended up co-hosting an open mic in Adams Morgan. And that was our gathering spot. We would go there and we'd go, oh, we would, it sounds kind of dorky now, but we like, we'd meet up and say, oh, you're so-and-so, like going off of each other's screen names or whatever. But those were the people throwing books at me. This, oh, you know, you may want to check out this. You like Nikki Giovanni. No, check out Nikki Giovanni. So then when I got to Nikki Giovanni, Nikki Giovanni's great, but if you like Nikki Giovanni, read Sonia Sanchez. Oh, okay, if you enjoyed that, check out Yusef Komunyakaa. And so all of these books are just coming at me. And I was reading them just to enjoy them, but subconsciously, I was learning. You know, I was seeing, you know, what these, I call master writers were doing and was kind of imitating it in my work. And, you know, but I didn't know at the time that, you know, I was going through a learning process, just reading and seeing what was possible on the page. So, yeah, I'd say I started poetry in high school, got serious about it in college. And, you know, the community I found, like the people that I'm still in touch with have, you know, kept me going. Actually, my best friend was one of the people on the freestyle board, and he was the best man at my wedding, and he's my daughter's godfather. But yeah, I mean, in a nutshell, that was my journey through poetry, you know, how I got into it and you know, what has, or what continues to sustain me now, so.
Talking about getting heckled in the early days, I feel like as a musician, I've cleared several rooms before. You know, like it's an experience that you can't get away from. You know,
no.
Especially early on, and I still have that fear every time I walk out on the stage that you know everybody's going to leave. You know. Is that something that has completely gone away? Has it been like a trajectory where like that's gotten better for you, or is it just something that you've like learned to get past sort of like psychologically?
I mean, I'm always nervous before I do a reading, but I think I've done it enough where I know as soon as I step out. And as soon as I get into the first poem, like that nervous energy, like I'm going to end up feeding off of it, you know, it turns to excitement. But, when I got heckled, I mean, yeah, it's not cool to be heckled, but I guess looking back, you know, like I just think it was, I don't want to say necessary, but I think that, yeah, it's like a rites of passage, you know, like, you know, the people that, you know, you enjoy, you know, whether it's musician or, you know, whatever in their craft, they went through some period where somebody wasn't feeling them or a room wasn't feeling them. And, you know, I think it's normal. But, yeah, for me, I think it's, you know, having done it enough. And also, too, like, I think, like, the more you practice in your craft, the more secure you become, and then that security, like you become more secure in your words, you become more secure in, you know, especially if you're practicing, especially if you are on the mic enough and you get used to hearing yourself, because I always tell folks, I think what usually trips people up is that they have two voices. You have this internal voice that you've heard all this life, whatever you talk. And then the external voice is usually, you know, for people who aren't comfortable hearing recordings of themselves, you know, when they hear it, they're like, ooh, I sound like that, you know, and, you know, you're like, oh, this is what everyone else is hearing when I talk. But I had this internal voice that sounds different. And so I think, you know, when we were the folks from, you know, the folks I met on the OK Player Board, when they were doing the open mic in Adams Morgan, we wouldn't have anybody show up. It would just, so we'd be reading to each other. And so it was good practice for us getting used to being on a mic, getting used to hearing ourselves, because Ray, who ran the record store, he would put this massive speaker out on Adams Morgan, so whoever was on the microphone would get heard, you know, by the folks walking by. And so that definitely helped us get over that fear. But I think again, it's, you know, once you practice your craft on the page and, you know, you get to a point where you're secure in your work and your decisions are deliberate in that, and then you start practicing on the mic, you know, after, I mean, those were the only ways that I knew that I got beyond. I guess what you were talking about is what, like stage fright or
Yeah, just the fear of clearing a room. Yeah, the fear of, I guess, just generally not being accepted when you go out there, you know?
it's that. And then the Busboys and Poets at 14th and V, my friend, the best friend, he was their first poet in residence. And there were times when they would have these events, and he and I would be on the corner of 14th and V reading poems. And we're reading poems, and people walking by us, not paying attention. Then there was another moment when I went to the North Beach Festival, had this huge stage, and people eating, they catfish, whatever, and I mean, they may glance at you, but you're pretty much a part of the ambiance or whatever. Like nobody's paying attention, so I guess that too, like those moments too, also helped me get, help me get over like the stage fright, but then also worrying about not being accepted.
I feel like there's a definite tie, there's a definite link between having instruments around and having like the financial stability to be able to have that stuff around because instruments are super expensive, you know. So even having that equipment around and stuff like that as a kid and having access to it, I feel like it's very important for the growth of an artist. Which might not apply to poetry as much, but how do you feel like what's your financial trajectory been over the course of your life, and how do you feel like that has interacted with your creativity or motivations to be creative?
Well, I definitely see, the ways where I was privileged. So like my dad, my parents being in a certain income bracket to where we were able to be, we lived comfortably, like they're not rich, but we had a comfortable upbringing. And so what that meant was like, when I wanted to go to Vona in California, and I was still in college and couldn't afford the plane fare and all that stuff, being able to go to my dad, and even though he wasn't, he's still not a huge fan of poetry, but he supported me, in his own way. So it was, buying me the plane ticket, paying for whatever it was. And so I definitely think I benefited from that, being able to have the means to get to workshops and to be exposed and be around other writers. So I mean, those, I'd say like those are the ways. Oh, well, the other way too was grad school. So, and this I would lean more heavily on my wife. So like ever since we met, I've always been telling her, oh, I'm gonna go get my MFA. I'm gonna go get my MFA. And when I moved there with her, we were living in this studio apartment. And she was getting ready to go back to school for her MSW. And she was like, well, hey, I'm going back for my master's. Why don't you go back for yours? You always keep saying you're going to go get your MFA. Why don't you go get it so we can both be in school at the same time? And so she went full time. I couldn't do that because one of us had to work. So I went, I did a low residency program. And I was able to, but the fact that I was able to write essays and get some sort of, I mean, I got student loans, but I was able to get some sort of scholarship to go. And that was very beneficial because I was able to, I ended up doing my MFA in the Stone Coast program. And, you know, being able to be there physically and be around writers that I look up to. But then also, too, like that whole Stone Coast experience for me was like laying some groundwork that I did not see happening. And what I mean by that was Joy Harjo was a visiting faculty member at Stone Coast. And she didn't stay long, but when she was there, I did a couple, you know, like the visiting faculty has to do a workshop with all the students in the program. And so when it came time for us to pick a mentor, I had thought about her, but I was like, nah, she's not really feeling my stuff. Like I had assumed, I said, yeah, she's not really feeling my stuff. I'm not going to embarrass myself. I'm not, you know. And so both the director of the program and the assistant director came up to me, you know, not together, but individually, and was like, hey, what do you think about, you know, being a mentee for Joy Harjo? And it was like, you know, she requested you. And I was like, oh, okay. And sure. So I did that, had a great semester with her. And she was very instrumental. She and Tim Siebels, who was also, Tim Siebels was a faculty member in the program. He's no longer there. But they were very instrumental in helping me shape my second book, Point Blank. And so when it came time for blurbs, you know, I had access to Joy Harjo, and, you know, it was awesome. Like, I reached out to her, and she was like, yeah, I was hoping you would, you know. And then the craziest thing happens. After she writes the blurb, she gets named U.S. Poet Laureate. And my publisher is like, sending me an email with smiley faces. But I say all that to say that, you know, had I not had gotten that push from my wife to go into the program when I did, had I not known about or taken advantage of the student aid and being able to get the scholarship to be in the program, you know, that, you know, me and Joy Harjo connecting like that, you know, it's likely that it wouldn't have happened, and I, you know, wouldn't have been able to, you know, establish this friendship that we have. And, you know, I say friends, I'm friends, but it's also clear too that I will always, Joy will always refer to me as her student, and I will always see her as teacher. But yeah, it's a great, that connection there was like one of the amazing experiences that came out of the grad school program.
And how do you feel like race and gender have played roles?
Oh, man. So I'll frame it like this. When I came into Stone Coast, I think a lot of the race work was happening before I came in. But I did hear some horror stories and some wild stories from like Patricia Smith when she was a student in Stone Coast, and just some things that people said to her. And actually it was her going to Annie Finch, who was director of the program at the time, and raising hell that the school started doing a discussion on race. And I wasn't there for the rough parts, because you know, when I came in, I think they, you know, like the rough part had already happened. So I was fortunate in that sense. But on the flip side of that, one of the things that drives my wife crazy is, you know, you have a lot of Black writers writing about the microaggressions that they've experienced from white institutions. And I think it's real. I think that's, it's, you know, still happens and people still experience that. But what you don't hear is about the microaggression that artists of color put on other artists of color. And so I've experienced this with like older writers who, you know, the only way they would look out for me, the only way they would give me a tip about something was if I, you know, so to speak, you know, knelt and kissed the ring, right? You know, and it was almost like this, like, hazing process, you know, like they had to haze you, and then you were, like, worthy of, like, this attention. And so, you know, I'm not going to name a particular writer, but It I mean, like, it drove my wife crazy. She's like, you know, they're writing about this, like, microaggression and all this stuff happening to them, but then they're turning around and doing it on, you know, the younger writers instead of lifting them up. And so, you know, so I think that I know in one instance, being outspoken about a certain poet, older writer, you know, like I might have missed out on some opportunities or whatever. But also, excuse me, also too, like, and I'm trying to frame this right. So so there is a black bookstore owner couple, and they only deal with black writers who are known. They won't, you know, if you don't have a name, if you don't have an audience like that, they're not really about you. And so crazy thing though is that this is this white couple in Severna Park, Maryland, who their whole approach is like the opposite. You know, they're looking for the local writers. And their form of advocacy is providing a space for local writers who, you know, and, you know, you could, I mean, some of the local writers they support have a huge following. And then some of them don't, but they'll still be on social media championing you. I've dropped off books there, and they've had the people in their store, like, championing my work. And, you know, my books that would have otherwise sat in my garage or something like that, unless I had a reading or whatever, which I haven't had in a while. But, you know, they're moving them. And it's a completely different approach. Like, when I talk to the woman who, and their bookstore, I could, you know, then, you know, they'll be happy I'm saying this, but their bookstore, Park Books in Severna Park, Maryland, Melody, she teaches at the nearby Naval Institution, and she was saying, you know, one day they were all in this meeting, and they were flying a writer from out of town, and they were paying all this money for, like, their travel, putting them up somewhere, you know, and just whatever was in the contract for them. And she was like, why are we spending all this money to bring somebody in, and we have all of these writers in our community that we're not uplifting? So the bookstore is like she and her husband's way of doing that. And so, yeah, it's funny. Like, so, yeah, like, I've gotten some opportunities from black institutions like Hurst and Wright, very grateful to them, Kaveh Khanum, I'm a fellow. But the opportunities, I've gotten opportunities from the black organizations that I've listed. You know, I've had, like, you know, non-black organizations, like, or people, like, I'll say you. But then also, in addition to you, it's Grace Cavalieri, who does The Poet and the Poem, which is getting ready to go to the moon. They're sending in the Lunar Codex. But anyway, like, yeah. And, like, with Grace Cavalieri, I didn't have to, like, kneel and kiss the ring and go through this whole process or anything like that. I didn't have to do that with Melody and her husband in Severna Park, Maryland. And so, you know, my wife is just always baffled. You know, you have people, well, you have specific writers writing about race and how race affects them. And what they're writing about is very real. I've experienced that too. But then I've also experienced the microaggression coming from people who look like me. You know, so it's wild. Like, but I felt like I had to talk about that because usually, you know, you'll hear the same, and I won't say tired because it's real, it's still happening, but you'll hear the same narrative about black versus white or white versus people of color, but you never hear about the microaggressions within a group of people, you know, and I've experienced that.
And there's even some of that, though, I think is applicable to just generally, like, the idea of having people who... You need to be popular. You need to have mm-hmm. like a certain mm-hmm. following or be liked by a certain set of people, mm-hmm. Or else they won't touch you. I mean, I think that applies to a lot of artistic areas. I mean, mm-hmm. in you know, and not racially motivated, even just mm-hmm. like if I'm in a room watching a band mm-hmm. and there's nobody else watching, I feel the need to stay there and watch the band to support them because mm-hmm. I feel bad if mm-hmm. if there's nobody there. Mm-hmm. But if the room is packed, I don't feel like I need to stay there.
You know, but they got their love already.
Yeah, yeah. They won't notice me leaving. You uh-huh. know? If you'll notice me leaving, I'll be more likely to stay. But if you mm-hmm. if you won't notice it and I'm not like particularly enjoying it, then I will definitely walk out. You know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's definitely a mindset of like sort of pandering to fame or trying to advocate for non-famous people. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, I say this too. Funny thing is like, and I. You know, when I talk to people who aren't a part of Kavikana, I totally, you know, agree with their, you know, I can totally relate with their frustrations because, like, one thing I will say about some things being racially motivated is, like, you'll have like, white institutions that want to do the DEI mm-hmm. thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But instead of doing the work themselves, and seeking out these writers or going through their networks and, you know, just seeking out writers that people within the networks are doing it, they'll kind of go to an organization like Kavikana and be like, oh, well, you know, they've been vetted. They've already vetted, right? And then Kavikana will, like, give them a list of writers who they... And, you know, the frustration from folks who aren't Kavikana, I'm like, well, dang, you know, if this is the way things is going to be... that I'm never going to get this opportunity because I'm not in this organization to even be considered mm-hmm. to be out for it, you know? And it's happening because, you know, I think it was certain instances where someone's like, okay, it's Black History Month or, you know, or they, again, they're doing the DEI thing, but it's just so easy to go to an established Black organization and be like, hey, we need writers for so-and-so. And then they, you know, the gatekeepers, you know, will decide who can do it or whatever versus someone like Grace Cavallari. Poet laureate of Annapolis. If you listen to the poet in the poem, she has everybody on there. You know, she has interviewed all the poets laureate on there. You know, any big name poet, I don't know if she's got Amanda Gorman, but she has their interviews archived. And then she turns the spotlight on people like me and like other folks kind of finding their way into this. And, you know, so when you go through the poet in the poem, it's a nice mix of like known and unknown, you know, and I've learned about people from listening to the show. But I mentioned Grace Cavallari because this is her just doing the work. Like she's not going to Kavikana and like, okay, I need somebody for the show. What she does is she's so plugged into the community that she'll say, huh, you know, she hears a writer that she likes. She's like, and she doesn't have a set aesthetic. Like you'll hear writers of different aesthetics on the poet in the poem. But like, yeah, if it's somebody she's been listening to for a while or she's been reading their work and she has their contact, she'll say, hey, I don't think I've had you on the poet in the poem. Would you like to be on the show? And that's how she's, you know, accumulated like all of these voices and that wonderful archive. But, you know, I mentioned her because she's definitely doing the work and it's genuine, you know, when they reach out and, you know, so I just had to mention that.
On a broader level, how do you feel about the placement of art in society historically and currently, and where would you like to see it go?
So for art, I'm going to talk about visual art. One of the things I did not know, and I'm glad that visual artists are thinking about this, is that a lot of them are getting ripped off. So, like, they'll sell an art piece to a famous person. That famous person holds on to that art piece, and then they'll turn around and auction it off. But then that artist doesn't get any royalties or anything from it. And so I was glad to see conversations about artists thinking in that way, and, you know, so that they can benefit when their work is resold you know, elsewhere. So I, in terms of economics, I do like that artists are, you know, thinking more economically, you know, so they don't get played. Terms of poetry, like I know I was happy when Amanda Gorman read at the inauguration, and I was happy for several reasons because I couldn't even imagine being the inaugural poet and having to write a poem that resonates with everyone. And, you know, the amount of pressure. But, like, she pulled it off because there have been so many inaugural poets where, like, you know, the discussions around it were just kind of like, yeah, did they really need, you know. But when she read at the inauguration, like, she pretty much outshined because she was who a lot of people were talking about. And a lot of people resonated with her. And because a lot of people resonated with her, people were going to the bookstores. People were like, oh, poetry's not so bad. Poetry's not, you know, people were getting over their poetry wounds from like elementary school. And like, you know, but like places like Park Books were smart enough where like they would get some Amanda Gorman books and they would position them in a way where, you know, people would learn about other poets in that section. So they were very strategic about, you know, where they placed these books by well-known authors on their shelves. But I think, I just remember being happy that people weren't talking about poetry as punishment, you know, after Amanda Gorman read at the inauguration. And I'm curious to see where poetry goes. I remember when I was submitting some of my poetry videos the fact that I could submit them to film festivals. I remember being blown away seeing that there was a category for poetry videos. And then you've got groups like, Motion Poetry that are like teaming up with poets and doing videos of their poems. But just, you know, I'm just really, you know, excited to see, you know, a category at film festivals for that, you know. And to me, it's telling that, you know, like more and more people are open to poetry. They're giving it a chance. I don't know if it's the whole Amanda Gorman thing or if it's just, you know, poetry videos. You know, it's still kind of like in the cult following phase, but it's where it wasn't, you know, a while ago. It's where it wasn't when I first started doing this, you know, so to see it get to that point. But I think art on a grand scale, the fact that STEM programs are becoming STEAM programs, you know, that's another sign that the presence of art getting out there and people taking it serious. You know, I'm happy to see that.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.